Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran reacts to the U.S. president's latest comments about global oil supply, saying that Washington has failed to remove Tehran from the international market. The Polish prime minister says NATO must take concrete steps over the migrant crisis along the country's border with Belarus. And British police arrest the three people under the Terrorism Act following a deadly car explosion in the northwestern city of Liverpool. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Now, Iran says that the United States has tried for decades to remove the country from the international market, but has failed to do so.
What Biden said indicates that no country can be eliminated from the international market. For decades, the Americans have tried to remove Iran from the global markets, but they have failed to do so due to the creativity of our youths who have overcome all obstacles.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says that the U.S. president has to be aware that Tehran is carefully monitoring his behavior. Said Khatibzadeh says Tehran will go to the upcoming talks for the removal of sanctions with an eye on Joe Biden's actions and comments. And those talks are scheduled to be held in Vienna on November 29th. On Friday, Biden said that there are sufficient supplies of petroleum worldwide, so other countries can cut their purchases from Iran. That's part of a policy that requires the White House to affirm every 6 months that there is enough oil supply globally to maintain sanctions against Iran. The Islamic Republic argues that the sanctions are illegal. So from Edinburgh, let me bring in John White, writer and political analyst, and ask his opinion about this. John, good to have you with us. So how do you evaluate this approach by the U.S.? On one side, they're urging Iran, they're asking the Europeans, also the signatories of the JCPOA, to get Iran to the negotiating table and resume the talks in Vienna on the nuclear deal. And on the other hand, they're trying to kind of isolate Iran from the international market, which hasn't happened, of course. As you know, Iran has had its own ways to circumvent and have its own customers.
Well, clearly no lessons have been learned in Washington vis-a-vis Iran's willingness and steadfastness when it comes to resisting this attempt at economic asphyxiation, which has been ongoing now for the last 4 years. Prior to that, there were sanctions against Iran before the nuclear deal was agreed in 2015 under the Obama administration. This is not, when it comes to Washington, the attempt or serious attempt of an administration to establish peaceful relations with a state that does not bow to its writ. This is Rome pronouncing judgment on Carthage. This is tawdry. This is international brigandage. This is in violation of all precepts of norms when it comes to diplomacy, when it comes to international obligations and relations and diplomatic agreements that have been set. And it really does set a bad precedent when it comes to Washington. I think historians will look back on this period as a major signpost on the road, not to Iran's decline as a power, but to Washington's imperial decline. This is a fading imperial hegemon trying desperately to shore up its power, its domination of a region that is no longer its to control at the behest of regional allies. The tail now is wagging the dog, and that tail resides in Tel Aviv and it resides in Riyadh.
Mm-hmm. And John, couldn't this even have some implications for the U.S. dollar? Because, you know, it's not only Iran, it's Russia, it's China, it's some other countries, Turkey, and we also have the BRICS and others. And they have tried to come up with some ways, actually, to stop using, for example, the U.S. dollar in their own transactions. And we have the organization of the Shanghai Organization, for example, Cooperation Organization. So what the U.S. is doing by, maybe what I'm saying is that by sanctioning countries like Iran, it's actually kind of pushing other countries closer together, and they are forming their own blocs and they're having their own business.
Well, this is law of unintended consequences. Necessity is the mother of invention. And necessity dictates that the U.S. dollar should not be seen as a viable, as a secure and stable international currency, given the vicissitudes of Washington when it comes to its relations with all the countries and the powers and the regions that you just mentioned. So that it is pushing the world towards an Eastern resolve when it comes to dealing with the West. The West is no longer the only game in town. It had been from the demise of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, but things have changed and changed utterly. So the world is looking to the East increasingly. China's Belt and Road Initiative is knitting vast swathes of the world together in a spirit of cooperation and mutual benefit. Whereas Washington is trying to still play by the old playbook of our game is the only game in town, and when we say jump, you say how high. This is no longer reality in the world. Interdependent on the basis of cooperation, on the basis of mutual respect for national sovereignty and for culture is the way ahead, and that's where the world is headed, regardless of what Washington and his allies says or does. Or tries to do to the contrary.
Okay, appreciate your insight. John White, writer and political analyst in Edinburgh. Now, clerics from several Muslim countries have held a virtual conference to discuss the situation in Afghanistan following its takeover by the Taliban. The participants touch upon several issues, including the formation of an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan. We have a report from Kabul.
On Sunday, the Afghan capital Kabul hosted a webinar titled Muslim World Ulamas and the Recent Developments in Afghanistan. Top clerics from seven Islamic countries, namely Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, Iran, Palestine, Iraq, and Croatia, participated in the event. They said the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan opened a new chapter in the country, adding that it's up to the new rulers to form an inclusive government and maintain stability.
Afghans are proud people. They succeeded to defeat the U.S. and its allies and free their country. We hope the new administration learns from the past and understands that no one can rule over Afghanistan with dictatorship and oppression. I think Afghanistan must have a popular and inclusive government in order to prevent disputes.
We welcome the recent developments in our country, as it is meant to cease hostilities and violence on our soil. We are happy that our people don't hear the news of war every day, or at least hear lesser than they did during the invasion. But the fact is that recent terrorist attacks show that we are still far from permanent security and peace.
The attendees also stressed the need for Islamic solidarity and urged the Taliban and Afghans to stay awake and knowledgeable to foil enemies' scheme.
My advice to the Afghan people is that they should launch an educational movement and everyone should be illiterate, so that they can detect enemies' plots. In addition, there should be a solidarity between Muslim brothers because their enemies are trying to sow sedition between Shias and Sunnis, especially by carrying out deadly attacks.
Addressing the conference, the clerics also asked the Islamic countries to help Afghans amid difficulties and economic hardship. The participants of the webinar stressed unity among all Muslims, especially in Afghanistan. This as the Taliban government is yet to be recognized by world countries and people are facing looming crisis. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Now, in other news, Poland is calling for active NATO intervention amid rising tensions over a migrant crisis along the Belarus-European Union border. The Polish Prime Minister is saying that mere expression of concern is not enough and NATO must take concrete steps. Mateusz Morawiecki says that Poland, Lithuania, and Latvia are considering asking NATO to hold emergency talks over the crisis along their borders with Belarus. It says that EU leaders would discuss further sanctions against Belarus, including completely closing the border. Thousands of migrants are stranded on the Belarus border in dire conditions as Poland denies them entry into the EU. Western countries accuse Minsk and Moscow of orchestrating a crisis. The two capitals have rejected the allegation, blaming the West for the issue. Alfred Desaias is a former UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion of democratic international order. We've spoken to him about Europe's migrant crisis, and Desaias says that the U.S. and its NATO allies are responsible for political conflicts that lead to mass migration and displacement of people.
Obviously, we have to look at the root causes, and the United States and NATO have a considerable responsibility for the crisis emanating in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, etc. So migration crisis must be addressed, but the priority now must be to do something for the people who are freezing, for the people who are hunger, Now, after we deal with that, how about just returning to sanity and doing away with the sanctions? Because the sanctions against Belarus, for instance, they also cripple the economy, as they have crippled the economy of Syria and crippled the economy of Venezuela and Cuba, etc. So lift the sanctions, sit down, talk rationally, and see how you can help people. And as far as migration is concerned,
the British police have arrested three people following a deadly car explosion in the northwestern city of Liverpool. The police saying that the three men, all in their 20s, were detained under the Terrorism Act. They say that they're keeping an eye, an open mind about the cause of the explosion. The incident happened just before 11 a.m. local time outside Liverpool Women's Hospital. The passenger of the car, said to be a taxi, died at the scene, but the driver was injured and transported to a hospital. An unconfirmed report suggesting the driver locked the passenger inside the car after seeing explosives with him. Authorities have launched an investigation. The Japanese economy shrinks faster than expected in the third quarter of 2021 as the COVID pandemic hits spending and exports. Government data indicating the world's third largest economy shrank by 0.8% in the 3 months of September. That's four times greater than expected and represents an annualized drop of 3%. The slowdown was partially driven by a dip in consumer spending during a coronavirus state of emergency in the summer. Supply chain issues also affected the production, hampering trade and exports. Okay, now let's get some insight on this. So let me invite Seijuru Takeshita, professor of management with the University of Shizuoka. Good to have you with us, professor. So how bad is the economic situation in Japan, and is the government on the right path to address the issue?
Well, it's a lot worse than expected because, as you just reported, private consumption was damped on back of the COVID-19. But that said, the issue is getting a lot better considering that, for example, yesterday there were only 22 contractions reported in Tokyo, which tells you that there's a definite simmering down. But again, of course, we're looking at what's happening in Europe, and there's another very big wave that is occurring. So obviously people haven't let their guards down. The real problem of the economy, at least at this point, is particularly the procurement side. The capital expenditure dropped quite significantly because we do not have enough goods, particularly the semiconductors. In addition to that, we've also got worries about, you know, rising oil prices and weakening the yen, which would be a double battering for the Japanese economy. But, you know, overall, I can clearly see that, you know, private consumption, which is the biggest component of the GDP, is definitely on its way back, particularly in areas like services.
Mm-hmm. And Professor, when do you see a full recovery?
Probably next year, mid next year. The government was hoping that, you know, the recovery will take place later this year, but there's no way that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Particularly because of the procurement problem that I was just talking to you about. So obviously we'd have to wait until next year, but the private consumption certainly will show a pretty good comeback under the hypothesis that, you know, the COVID-19 contraction will remain low. And we are already seeing some of the pent-up demand, we call it revenge, you know, demand in Japan, but is certainly coming back quite nicely, particularly on the service sector.
Okay, appreciate your comments. Seijuru Takeshita, professor of management at the University of Shizuoka. Now, no end in sight to Saudi Arabia's military aggression against neighboring Yemen. According to Yemeni media, Saudi warplanes targeted an area east of the city of Hais in Hodeidah province, killing three civilians and injuring seven others. The Riyadh launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have lost their lives, and millions more have been displaced. The years-long aggression has also targeted the country's infrastructure, leaving the people in abject misery. The UN has called the situation in Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The Palestinian Authority is facing a financial crisis. For months, it's been struggling to meet its obligations to contractors while facing continuous difficulty in paying its employees and workers. Mona Kandil has the story from Ramallah.
The Palestinian Authority is experiencing the worst fiscal difficulties it has ever had since its establishment more than a quarter century ago. PA officials say this could soon reflect on its ability to pay its employees' salaries and conduct daily business. The European Union is the PA's largest single donor, but the bloc has not donated any aid to the authority so far in 2021. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohamed Ishtayi has meanwhile told his cabinet several days ago that the PA hasn't either received any financial aid from the Arab countries for 2 years.
There's no doubt that the PA is going through a real and suffocating financial crisis. Its manifestations are evident. There's a budget deficit, an accumulation of debt, and delays in paying its obligations, the salaries, paying for the education, infrastructure, health, and all sections. It's undeniable that there is a clear decline in aid.
Along with the long-standing fiscal leakages that are contributing to the financial crisis, Israel continues to deduct millions of U.S. dollars every month from clearance revenue transfers. This is in response to the payments by the Palestinian Authority to the prisoners held in Israeli jails, their families, and the families of those killed by Israeli forces.
Taxes collected by Israel on behalf of the PA, including customs duties, constitute a major source of revenue for the Palestinian economy. Israel often uses the fund transfers as a bargaining chip in its volatile relationship with the PA. They do not want for the PA to have any strength. They want to use the money it deducts to keep control in a way or another on the PA.
Meanwhile, the World Bank called on donors to help reduce the budget deficit, saying that the financial situation remains fragile due to high public spending and very low external financing to the PA.
At the end of the day, observers have expressed concern that the increasingly cash-strapped PA could face financial collapse. PA officials say the main reason behind the financial crisis is the lack of international and Arab donations to the Palestinians. Wana Kandil, Occupy Jamallah.
Projections from Argentina's midterm parliamentary elections indicating the ruling coalition has lost control of Congress. President Alberto Fernandez's coalition is projected to drop from 41 to 35 seats in the 72-member Senate. More than 90% of the ballots have been counted. The conservative opposition is leading in most key regions, including in the populous province of Buenos Aires. Nearly half of the lower chamber seats were up for grabs, as well as a third of Senate seats. Argentina has been hit with an economic crisis, with public discontent grown over the rising poverty and inflation. The crisis has been escalated by the COVID pandemic in the past 2 years.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh my God! Oh, I'm late. I might miss the flight. The traffic was very heavy. My ticket. Where is my ticket? Oh, I found it. Here it is. Oh. Find the check-in gate for my flight. I'm going to take a trip to Dezful, and after that, I'm going to visit the city of Shush. Today, I'm going to visit Shush Museum. Shush, or Susa, is a city located in Khuzestan province in southwestern Iran. Shush is one of the most ancient cities in the world. This city is 24 kilometers away from Dezful. The ancient city of Shush is the capital of thousands-year-old Elamite civilization. This city has also been the winter capital of Achaemenid Empire. Shush Museum has some of the important treasures that have been discovered during the excavations of this city. Shush Museum is located near Acropole Hill, which is one of the most important archaeological sites of the world. Many of the objects that were discovered during the excavations of this hill are now kept in Shush Museum. This museum is located near Shush Castle, which is known as the French Castle, because it used to be inhabited by French archaeologists for a while. Shush Museum has six halls, four big halls, and two small halls. The four big halls of Shush Museum keep the relics of Elamite, Achaemenid, Parthian, and Sasanid eras. Oh, I finally reached the beautiful city of Shush. Now I'm waiting for a taxi, which is going to take me to Shush Museum. To be honest, I'm really excited because I don't know what unique things I'm going to see at Shush Museum. And now I am in the big garden of Shush Museum. The building of the museum is a beautiful brick-made structure and is located in the middle of the garden. The walls around the garden are short, yet the trees in here are tall. They're taller than the walls. Here, there are pomegranate trees, palm trees, eucalyptus trees, and jujube. Some of the statues or archaeological relics are kept in glass showcases. Their characteristics are written on a metal plate. Oh, look at here. Here is a big stone statue of an animal which has its tail stuck to its body. I don't know what kind of animal it is. It's amazing anyway. And a few meters away, there are the columns of Apadana Palace. And I am now inside the museum. Just in front of me, there is the statue of Hercules. It's Hercules standing calm, squeezing a lion's neck with his hands. What a wonderful statue! It belongs to the Parthian era. And here, there is the statue of a winged horse. This horse has been discovered from the Apadana Palace, yes. Oh well, this museum is full of unique things which have no pair anywhere in the world. Some of them include Elamite and Parthian head sculptures, stone inscriptions with Sumerian alphabets, sculptures of animals' heads, so many wares and decorative objects and armbands, etc. Well, describing these ancient objects needs time, and I suggest you to travel to the city of Shush and visit this great museum.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. A New York Times report reveals how the U.S. military bombed civilians in Syria and then bulldozed the site to try to cover up the news. A 500-pound bomb was dropped on mostly women and children. Then it was followed by two more bombs, taking care of any survivors. At the end, at least 80 people were killed. The U.S. says 16 of them were fighters and four were civilians, and they did not bother to even try to describe who the others were. However, they had decided to sit on the news of this act to try to avoid being accused of committing a war crime. Stay with us as we take a look at this event on this Spotlight.
It's March 18th, 2019. An American F-15 drops a 500-pound bomb on a crowd of women and children in an area near the town of Baghouz in Syria's Deir ez-Zor province. Minutes later, another warplane drops an even bigger bomb, then another, killing the few survivors of the first strike. The initial death toll was put at 70. Fast forward to November 2021. The U.S. Central Command has acknowledged that 80 people were killed in the strikes. While claiming that 16 of the victims were Daesh terrorists, it admits that it's unclear if the rest were civilians. CENTCOM has also defended the attacks as justified and conducted in self-defense, arguing that the targeted women and children could have been combatants. But investigations carried out by the New York Times provide a different account of the incident. According to the Times, a U.S. Air Force lawyer who oversaw the operation believed he had witnessed possible war crimes and notified the authorities. The Pentagon later carried out an independent inquiry into the incident, but the Times says the subsequent report was, quote, stripped of any mention of the bombing. The newspaper also says the reports were delayed and classified, and the attack site was bulldozed shortly after.
So this is one piece that is coming out, very important, because it shows just how criminal the war is and the cover-up that takes place at every level, even when within the Army, those who saw it and have access tried to bring it to light and instead were dismissed.
The report bore a striking resemblance to a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul in late August this year that claimed the lives of 10 members of the same family, including 7 children. The U.S. military initially said it had targeted a Daesh terrorist planning a suicide attack in the wake of the bombing at the Kabul airport that had killed 13 U.S. troops and dozens of Afghan civilians 3 days before. The Pentagon similarly defended the botched strike as a, quote, righteous one.
Daniel Hale, the former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst who worked with the NSA, who worked with JSOC, is now going to be spending the next 45 months in prison for having let the world know that 90% of the victims of U.S. airstrikes are innocent bystanders, basically civilians.
To put things into perspective, the United States conducted about 1,000 airstrikes in Syria and Iraq in 2019 alone, using over 4,700 bombs and missiles. The official civilian toll for the entire year is 22.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight, William Jones from Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg, Virginia. And Danny Shaw, author and international affairs analyst out of New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us on this spotlight. Let's start this off with William. I mean, why has it taken almost 3 years for this news to be exposed? I mean, there had been people in the area who were eyewitnesses, as well as the central command in Qatar, that watched the whole event via drone footage. So why did it take so long?
Well, this was obviously a major cover-up. We don't know how often this happens. I mean, the fact that there was a whistleblower here and this has been revealed probably indicates that there are maybe dozens more of such incidents that are never reported. It was a tremendous operation, so many people who were killed in this, a tremendous mistake on many, many levels. And then it was increased by a conscious attempt to bury it. And this is which is the bigger crime. The death of the individuals, of course, is the most horrendous. But the fact that this can occur without oversight condemns the entire war operations that the United States is conducting in this region. And it also points out the fact that the United States war in Syria is a serious breach, a serious crime of itself, because if they had been working with the Syrian government, which they're fighting against, they could have revealed already that what the problem was, what was the situation on the ground, and this would have never occurred. But the fact that the United States has placed itself in opposition to the legitimate government of Syria is really the basic problem that we're dealing with here, leading to this tragedy.
Danny, why do you think the New York Times has actually revealed this news? I mean, as William said, there are so many incidents that probably take place and go about with little or no reporting, especially in the corporate media. Your assessment of that?
Well, as if we needed more proof that to the U.S. military-industrial complex, Syrian lives do not matter, Kurdish lives do not matter, Palestinian, Iranian, Iraqi, Afghan lives do not matter. Why is it taking 3 years for this to come to light? How many other similar incidents with all of the drones and bombs the U.S. is piloting from Somalia to Yemen to the invisible bombs that they drop every day on the Venezuelan people, on the Cuban people, now rejuvenated sanctions against the Nicaraguan people. The U.S. has no right to be in Syria in the first place. So hopefully this sparks these important conversations about Syrian self-determination. No one has endured more suffering than the Syrian people in their struggle against Daesh. And as has become very clear, Daesh has powerful, powerful international backers. This has never been a civil war in Syria. It's been an internationalized conflict with the Saudis and the Turks and, of course, the largest imperialist overlord, the U.S., backing any anti-Assad, any anti-Syrian Arab army forces that they can.
Well, William, the U.S. military authorities say that 16 of those killed out of 80 were fighters. And even if they are correct, how can they justify killing so many women and children? And if they didn't know when they dropped the first bomb that there were civilians there, why did they drop a second and a third?
Well, this is a very good question. I mean, the New York Times has a lot of details on this, the fact that the people who were calling in these bombs were a very, very secret operation, and many of the monitors that existed, including one of the cameras, one of the high-resolution cameras that were looking at it, was not available to them. But they had the authority to call in this tremendous operation, allegedly only to be done if they were under fire, which, of course, was not the case here. So there was a tremendous breach of even the rules of war, as is understood by the American military, and it may very well amount to war crimes. That a court, I think, will have to decide on that. But it's just really gotten out of control. The whole war situation has gotten out of control. And if the U.S. continues in this direction, you're going to have many more things like this. But I think that now that whatever the reasons were for the New York Times to reveal this thing, it was surprising for me that they did it and not somebody else, I think will lead to a major investigation, not only of this specific incident and not only of the rules of war as we know it today, but also will call into question the very commitment that the U.S. has made to fight against the legitimate regime of Assad in Syria. And perhaps there will be a reaction against this whole kettle of fish that has been built up by the military outreach and extended operations of the United States worldwide.
Well, William, just staying with you, because you just talked about not sure why the New York Times revealed it as they have, because that was my previous question, why did they do it? But now that they have, do you think perhaps that we are entering a type of transition, perhaps some type of reckoning, that actually the mainstream media is willing to critically look at what has taken place and what is continuing to take place in Syria?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that, knowing the mainstream media. In this instance, I probably suspect that the people who were involved in exposing this, who actually presented the information also to a congressional committee, and we're not getting a whole lot of response from them, also felt that by going public, they would get that response. Things would start to move. And of course, they went to the New York Times, and I don't think the New York Times is, you know, is going to let a story like this go when they can make some hay out of it and make also profit out of that. But I don't think there's been a main change in the mainstream media. They go along to get along, and the change has got to come elsewhere. It's got to come from the American people, and it's got to come from the American people putting pressure on their congressmen to stop this war. We know the situation generally. President Biden got out of Afghanistan because there's a general mood not to be in the war fighting business here in the United States. And that mood has got to make itself felt among the legislators if we're ever going to avoid problems like we see in this incident.
Okay.
So I don't think there should be a change there, but I think there is a tremendous change in the public mood against this type of war-fighting, policeman-like operations that the U.S. has been conducting over the whole world.
Well, Danny, there was an investigation, an incident, but it was internal. Now, if U.S. forces thought that their attacks were actually justified, why did they bulldoze the area then to try to hide the evidence?
Yeah, it's like the NYPD or any police department investigating themselves. We could never trust that investigation. It should be the Syrian authorities, the just authorities of the region who investigate. Certainly when the entire area was bulldozed, that is very telling. It does come as a type of shock that it was the New York Times, one of the main mouthpieces of the military-industrial complex. The New York Times, together with the Washington Post and CNN, the whole gamut of neoliberal media has always beat the drums of war, bombs away on Yugoslavia, bombs away on Panama, bombs away on Libya, nothing but unfettered aggression against Syrian self-determination. But within these mainstream corporate media complex, you are going to have certain critical voices. Perhaps this was going to be leaked somewhere else. So, as William said, the Times got ahead of it so they could cash in on what is more Syrian suffering.
Well, William, one of the Air Force's lawyers, Lieutenant Colonel Dean Corsack, believed that he had witnessed a war crime and tried to tell higher authorities, but nothing happened except that he was sidelined. And, I mean, we have seen whistleblowers, especially in dealing with the military-industrial complex, paying a major, major price. But the actual problem is really never addressed. Your take on this?
Well, it seems to me that there's an issue here of why this attack was called for in the first place. And according to the rules of war, it could be done only if the people calling it were in danger, and that doesn't seem to be the case now. But you've had them bending the rules a lot in this respect. And by bending the rules, they probably got to a point where they actually broke the rules. And we'll have to figure out if there was culpability on the part of the people involved in this thing and that it
well,
was
well, let me just jump in here. You say bending the rules, William, but even according to what you said earlier, which of course is true, I mean, the U.S. being there is actually illegal, right? Because the sovereign government never invited them in. So do you think that basically rules here are as the Americans create them as they go? Because if we start from the first point of it, it's illegal for them to even be there.
That's correct. That is the fundamental the fundamental crime here is the war in Syria, in which we are actually supporting groups that would ordinarily be called terrorists because they're in opposition to President Assad, and we are also opposed to the Assad regime. That is the primary problem, that it's a legitimate government that was elected by the people. They're conducting the operations of the country, and we're trying to conduct a revolution against them in the operations in Syria. That's the primary crime, but there are also two other issues here. Was there a crime, even according to the rules of war for the United States, conducted in this particular incident? And more specifically, there must have been a crime. There was probably even a greater crime in covering it up, because the cover-up itself can be an illegal matter which will lead to jail time. Obviously, somebody will get fired, but could even be jail time for people who perpetrated the cover-up. And I think that's what we're going to see moving forward. And I think this is going to be very much in the public view. And I think that will be very useful to teach the American public about what's actually going on.
But at the
Syria.
End of the day, William, sorry to jump in. At the end of the day, if anyone pays, what we have seen in the past is usually that it's some low-level military personnel that actually ends up paying the price. Never the higher-ups, the general or whomever gave the actual order. I mean, we have seen that time and time again, that those who are mostly responsible for these crimes never pay a price.
That's absolutely right. And I think the problem is that the American citizenry have got to become much more enraged about this thing in order to force a change of policy and to hold those responsible who have been responsible for war crimes. And it's not simply the soldiers on the ground who are carrying out orders. It's the people who are giving the orders in a war that is unjustified, that is illegal, and that is itself a crime against humanity.
Well, Danny, in general, why aren't these cases like this taken more seriously? Because if they're not investigated, excuse me, and the right people actually punished, then it's going to be repeated time and time again. Are lives in this region of the world less important for the American military?
That's 100% correct. I mean, what is legality to the U.S. unipolar hegemon? They could care less about international law. They trample over this paper law and mock it all day, every day, across the world, in every continent, in every ocean. How many hundreds and hundreds, 800 plus U.S. military bases stationed around the world to patrol and surveil and invade and occupy the sovereignty of any country on earth? As William has said, the underlying sin, the original crime, is the invasion, the occupation. Why is there one U.S. troop in Syrian territory? It's such an incredible double standard. They would never allow one Cuban soldier or one Syrian soldier within the U.S.'s territorial boundaries. And what we've continually seen, when there are brave whistleblowers, they go after these whistleblowers, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, with everything to send a clear message to the everyday Americans and GIs in the military, don't you dare raise your voice, or we'll put you in a box, we'll lock you up, we'll put you away forever, striking fear into how many young people who actually want to do the right thing. So when has the military brass, when have the West Point graduates, the generals, ever done a day in jail, been court-martialed? And the true war criminals, from Obama to Bush to Trump to whoever's in the Oval Office right now, it's bipartisan. These are war criminals on both sides of the aisle, and they need to be held responsible. But it'll never be the New York Times. It'll never be this system that holds the war criminals responsible. It has to be a mass movement in the streets. And hopefully this can be a teachable moment so that more young people join this anti-imperialist movement.
Well, William, again, if these crimes are not paid for, the situation would obviously just be repeated. I mean, we saw in Afghanistan just a few months ago when Americans bombed a house and killed 10 civilians, including 7 kids. At first, Washington reported it was an attack on Daesh, and then it was forced to admit that it had killed civilians. And so far, nothing has been done. No compensation, nothing, although the U.S. gave some verbal commitments. And, of course, these people's lives cannot be returned either way. So shouldn't there be more severe punishment? And if it's not going to come from within, what needs to be done? What kind of system needs to be set up to hold them responsible?
Well, you know, the United States and President Biden is always harping on the so-called rule of law. When he's talking about Russia, he's talking about China. Obviously, there should be a rule of law which is beneficial for the population. And now that it's on the table, I think other countries as well will be talking about how must the world operate, how must countries work together in order to create better situations for their citizenry. I think that you'll see on the international scale an attempt to maybe not legislate, but at least to create a framework of legislation for how countries have to act, how they have to act if they have to go to war, and how they can stop going to war. But I think also in the country, as your other speaker said, there is a reaction from the American people, and it's a very divided country at the moment, and I think people will be out on the streets demanding change at the highest levels of this type of policy making, which they've just become tired of.
Well, Danny, at just 1 minute we have left, do you think the only guarantee for the safety of the people in this region is that the U.S. must leave Western Asia?
No question. U.S. out of the Middle East, the U.S. out of Asia, the U.S. out of the Caribbean, the U.S. out of every territory that they've invaded. How many coups post-World War II? How many coups, how many illegal invasions and occupations and drone bombings in the last century plus? But every dog has his day. None of these generals, none of these statesmen are invincible. The sun set on the British Empire and the Tsarist Empire. It will soon set on U.S. imperialism, the most powerful, arrogant empire in human history, so that at last the world's people can breathe in peace and get this imperial knife out of their neck.
And with that note, I appreciate both of you being with me. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg, Virginia, and Danny Shaw, author and international affairs analyst out of New York. And we appreciate you being with us on the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam. Hello and welcome to our audience, and a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. This is a program dedicated to the life and times of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And I have a good friend, academic and Islamic scholar, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, to join me to discuss his life and times. Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, salam, and welcome to the program.
Alaykum salam, rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, we're going to discuss wealth disparity according to how the Imam saw it.
Yes.
Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. I leave the floor entirely to you, sir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Just a little intro in the sense that we had a program.
We did. And we discussed.
There was a report
from Oxfam, yes.
Published.
Yes.
A report in which they talked about the fact that, you know, we have this massive, crazy wealth disparity in the world.
Yes.
And one of the statistics that they...
It's reached diabolical proportions.
Exactly. Diabolical is exactly the word.
Yes.
Where they basically said that the 85 richest individuals...
Yes.
I repeat, individuals.
Individuals. In 85 individuals.
Individuals, okay, in the world...
Yes.
...own the same amount of wealth as...
3.5 billion...
The bottom half of the entire world's population. Okay, let's just let's do a little experiment here.
Okay.
Okay. Imagine 85 people.
Yes.
Would they fit into where would they fit? Like, just so that we get an idea of how little 85 people are.
Basically,
a double-decker bus.
A double-decker bus.
Right.
Would be sufficient. Yeah.
A double-decker bus.
A London double-decker bus would take 85 people.
Right. One train carriage?
Or one train carriage.
Or maybe two?
Perhaps two.
Right?
Yeah. With difficulty.
A medium-sized boat?
A medium-sized boat, yeah.
Yes?
Yes.
You know, half a football field?
Yeah. Or half the seats in a passenger aircraft?
Right?
Yeah.
Correct?
Absolutely.
That's 85 people.
85 people.
Versus?
3.5 billion.
Right. That's all of China.
Yeah, all of China, India.
India, and some on top of that.
And some on top of that, yeah.
Yes?
Yes.
Good?
It makes perfect sense.
Okay. So I'm just saying this so that we get a picture of it.
My God, stunning.
And these two groups...
Two groups, yeah.
...have the same amount of wealth.
Same amount of wealth.
Yeah. It's really hard to digest.
It is.
But remember, this is Oxfam.
Mm-hmm.
This is not like, you know, the... I don't know, the anarchist, whatever.
Anarchist institution of proclaimed terrorism.
Right, it's not like...
Or the Salafist beheading
of... Right, it's not like some dude...
Institute in of beheading, you know, your local neighbor.
Right, it's not some dude running, you know, a website out of his, you know, grandma's basement or something, you know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. This is Oxfam.
Yeah.
Oxfam.
Okay.
Right. Who's done enormous
research.